to move forward, even though we do not have a quorum. So we will not be voting on any actions today, which would include the disciplinary actions that are scheduled to be heard by the council, unless our 10th member shows up. That would then constitute a quorum. So I apologize for that. We had several members that asked to be excused. Those include Chief Carpenter, Chief Burbank, Officer Christy Morin, Deputy John Crowley, Commissioner Gibson, and Mayor Johnson. They're unable to make the meeting today, which has put us in the predicament that we're in now. At this point, I'd like to, can we even approve the minutes? Apparently not, since we have to vote on those. So we'll move right to the post-budget director's report on his budget. Director Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair, Council. Wanted to report to you on our 2013 budget challenges. The three previous years, post-staff has worked very hard to reflect some savings, and with the legislature approval, have carryover. And we've been granted that the last 3 years, and we're able to reflect a savings of up to $400,000 to help us with the low times of the surcharge account, as I'm sure all you are aware of how that's generated. For whatever reason, this year was awful for the surcharge account, and we came in $400,000 under budget. And with that $400,000 that we saved, had to fill that hole, so we're trying to find ways to cut back on some programs and initiatives. And I've been working closely with Commissioner Squires to do that. I want to thank him for the support, and Colonel Fuhrer for working with us on this budget to help us keep going and not have to deal with this time and time again. So it's been a benefit to have those two in my corner. Any questions about why the budget, or any questions about the budget that you may have?
Do you foresee it as being an ongoing issue, or do you think it's just a one-time problem?
It has been. It's been a trend over the last 4 years, actually.
And is it, how has it been gapped in the years past?
The first of the year, the first couple of months, it drops below the average allocated amount, and then it'll creep up a little bit, and then drop, and then usually I'm operating in the red until March. And the way the surcharge account is generated, I do not find out my budget until a month after the fact. So right off the bat, I'm in the red. March, April, and May is when I come out of the red and into the black at the end of the fiscal year. And this year that did not happen. And that's why we had the shortfall. So right now I'm going over every expenditure, every area to see where I can cut. But I'll tell you right now, and I'm proud to say that we are very lean. I don't know what else to do, and that's why I've solicited the commissioner and the colonel and trying to help me shore this up so that we can continue providing the service statewide.
Very good.
So, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Director Stevenson. Next, we'll hear from Lieutenant Wade Brewer on the crisis intervention team training that we discussed at our last meeting.
Chairman, do you think it would be okay to do the satellite audits first, since I think there might be some more discussion with the CIT training follow-up? So there was two audits that were performed this last quarter. The first audit was actually the Sauk County Sheriff's Office met with their new training staff, and they had just begun a new class. All is going well there. No exceptions were found to the audit. And then I met with Chief Bob Flowers, Robert Flowers down here, who is the director over the Dixie State University program, Monday, so prior to this meeting, and no exceptions were found to this audit as well. I would like to share two comments made by both the training staff there, and they are very pleased with the new online records management program, which the testing takes place through, and their staff, their support staff, has full access to that. They can schedule the test, and it's very user-friendly. So those are some of the comments that we're getting back, as we work through our technology transition. As you know, the application process is all completely online now, so we work very closely with the satellites as their cadets are registering and filling out all of their applications. They're constantly calling up, finding out, okay, how many people of my class have registered, and the technicians very easily go in there and query that information, find out who it is, and then they can ensure that those applications are getting sent over to the investigative staff to review and approve. So any questions on the satellite audit process or any of the satellite programs? All right, thank you. Okay, moving on to the crisis intervention team training, which obviously was from the last meeting. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what we have done between the last meeting and now. Made a lot of contacts to not only those who administer the crisis intervention team training for the state of Utah. That, if you don't know, that program is under contract to be administered through the Salt Lake City Police Department. Ron Bruno is the coordinator for Utah. And if you remember, we wanted to see if it's feasible to go ahead and just create CIT certification as a component of the academy training. We're still working towards that, but I've found that there are some difficulties and some challenges with doing this. And some of those challenges include the way that those programs are funded. The Department of Human Resources has a division, the Division of Health, and they are the Division of Health and Human Services. They are the ones who fund these 17 or so academies throughout the state each year. Well, if we were to put this program into the curriculum, that would more than double the amount of classes that are put on statewide. So from 17, we would add another 20-something, depending on how many academies are put on statewide. And so that's the first challenge we're trying to overcome. The second challenge is what that does to the local resources as far as the professionals who teach this. Now, Department of Human Services funds those academies, and they're anywhere from $5,000 to $7,000 per class. So when I talked to the Human Services folks, they said, there's no way we're going to be able to fund your program to be able to continue those CIT trainings. And everybody that we've talked to, from the medical personnel that are supportive of this program to everybody that's involved in law enforcement, recognizes that we do need more training. Definitely need more training in the basic program. We're not sure if CIT is the answer. So our recommendations to the council, and obviously I don't think we can vote on this yet, but our recommendations are going to be for us to create, or for you to create, a subcommittee to help us, the full-time staff, kind of work through the issues and work through creating what is it that we need to have for the basic training curriculum. Whether it is we go forward with CIT or we create something like, there's programs out there that are called mental health first aid. And it's a 40-hour program to train the trainer, but then it's usually an 8-hour curriculum that we might be able to add. And that would allow for officers coming out onto the road with a little bit more knowledge and know-how to be able to deal with mental health crises. It's more along the lines of, this is not a law enforcement problem, but it is a health care program, but officers are on the front lines dealing with this. And we do need to bolster what they are available to be able to handle this, how they can handle this. So that's kind of what we found. And so I would just like to open it up to the council to see, answer any questions that the council has that we've researched. And
okay, on the first point, Lieutenant Brewer, doubling the number of classes.
Correct.
That would be just an initial surge of classes, because the majority of the CIT classes are servicing in-service officers that need to get that certification.
That's correct.
So that's going to just be a quick blip, and then that will no longer be an issue.
I would agree with that. If we can get over this original And whether it takes us a year or 2 years for that to catch up, to where then all the officers that are in the queue, now you don't have to send back because, like, for instance, you as a law enforcement administrator, you want all of your officers, if I understand right, to be CIT certified in your department.
Yes.
Salt Lake City's the same way, and I'm not sure how many other agencies are that same way.
The majority of departments are rapidly understanding the legal liability for not having their officers adequately prepared to deal with individuals suffering from mental health crisis or issues at the time.
Yes.
So I think there was a great deal of interest from all law enforcement administrators. In fact, I have yet to talk to anybody throughout the state in law enforcement that doesn't want to see this somehow incorporated into the basic academy, because the problem that we're having is when it becomes an in-service class, it's difficult to then take people out of service for a 40-hour class. It's much easier to get it done before we even get them on the road.
Yes. Yep. You're right on point, Chief. Talked to another administrator who works at the Salt Lake County Jail yesterday, and his name's Mark Ellsworth. He is over there, their services division as administrator, and he talked about what Director Cook mentioned in the last meeting of the number of use of force complaints that went down from 1 year to the next. And he made mention of that. It's kind of a pain to get these officers, especially those who work in the mental health services unit, back into the CIT program to get them trained up. But he didn't have an answer for us of how do we administer this? How do we not tax the health services groups throughout the state? And some of them are not even participants in the CIT training program. For instance, down in Sheriff Smith's area, he doesn't have anybody that's supporting this program. So those are hurdles we are going to have to overcome and figure out how do we implement this thing statewide.
Okay. Well, welcome, Sheriff Tracy. We now have a quorum, so we'll be handling all items on the agenda today. Anybody on the council have questions for Lieutenant Brewer or want to participate in a subcommittee to help post staff figure out how we're going to bring this program to the academy?
One question. I'm sorry I wasn't here, but as far as in-service training, we partnered with NAMI, and they've been phenomenal in supplying a lot of people and training and information. I don't know if that's an option in your areas, but if you have a NAMI group, they are phenomenal to work with.
Yeah, NAMI is the organization in which CIT is administered under. Correct.
Colonel? Is this a program that you can have your curriculum currently teach, or does it have to be a health provider?
No, it does have to be health provider. There is one little segment towards the end when they do the law enforcement scenario training that officers come in and help with, but more than, it's like 75 to 80% of the curriculum is taught by healthcare professionals.
Any other questions? Dr. Chekas?
I would be interested in participating in any kind of a subcommittee.
I think that'd be very appropriate. Thank you.
I would as well.
Okay. Director Cook?
But I think if we had, the one or two, that would be sufficient. Help give us guidance and direction. And
well, Sheriff Tracy, perhaps we could get a representative from the Sheriff's Association, and I'll look at getting somebody from the Chiefs Association as well.
Perfect.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Lieutenant Brewer.
Excellent. Thank you, council members.
Okay, next on our agenda is a presentation by Sheriff Curtis. Sheriff, welcome to the council. Come on up.
Thank you for letting me be here today. I appreciate your time, and I don't want to take too much of your time. The reason I'm here today is I'm here to ask permission to have a satellite special functions officer academy in Sevier County. About 3 years ago, I came before this same group and got that same permission. We've actually hired everybody that was in that group except for two, and they're quite active on our reserves, and we're seeing it was a huge benefit to our county and the counties around us. Wayne County Sheriff's Office participated in that, along with Richfield City Police Department. And it was a big benefit for all of us. We used post instructors. Everything went on in our facility. We had some people come down from post, teach some very specialized classes to help us out. And it was a really good benefit for not only the deputies that I have, but with all the agencies around. And it was a big benefit to us. And so we found that through that it was a good experience. And that's why I'm here today again, to ask for permission and the opportunity to do this in the future.
Sheriff and I have spoken in detail about this. The last class was a huge success. It was a good partnership between the two organizations. I also spoke with Sheriff Gleave, who is very much in favor of this. The pool of applicants in that area is almost non-existent, and I think this is would be a good endeavor to approve.
Especially financially for both agencies, especially where these guys are volunteers, getting them through, giving them an opportunity to really get into the field. And so it helps agencies, and we have areas where we use them and help them. So it's a big benefit to us.
All right. Anybody have questions for Sheriff Curtis?
You know, I think it's a great idea. Anything that we can do, especially to get training out to the rural parts of the state, because it's just so difficult to get up to Salt Lake, especially when you're using volunteers, it really benefits the state as a whole and our rural communities. So with that, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll make that motion. I think it'll help my county out. Good.
Definitely. I know we spoke to several of the sheriffs around us. So.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Second.
Sheriff Edmonds, thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Congratulations, Sheriff.
Thanks you. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Attention. All right. Now that we have a quorum here, we need to go back and approve the minutes of our June 5th meeting. So I trust everybody had a chance to review those before the meeting. So do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
Okay, Robbie and
all set.
Sheriff Edmonds, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Or as you may recall, last meeting and the meeting before that, we asked for some guidance from Mr. Bolander on what disciplinary documents could be provided to the council prior to this meeting. So we're ready for a report from Mr. Bolander today.
Good afternoon, members of the council. This is a follow-up from a question that came from the last meeting, the meeting before that, which is, can POST provide, or should POST provide, the investigative file or more information in addition to what you're already getting? Because right, as of now, you are receiving the pleadings, which would be the notice of agency action, and either one of three things, depending on what the respondent does, which will be either an ALJ decision with findings of facts or a hearing waiver or a default order. Sometimes we also receive a letter from the head of the administrative of the law enforcement agency that officer or dispatcher works for. But that's what the file has been limited to. And so the question was, can POST provide more, can probably like say the investigative file to give the council members more information? I had some initial concerns that I needed to research, and I consulted with my colleagues at the Attorney General's office. And based on those discussions and my research, I have concluded, and my recommendation is that POST not provide the investigative file in addition to what the member is already receiving. And the primary reason for that is, the investigative file, POST's investigative file, is not part of the administrative record. And when it's not part of the administrative record, and the council starts using information outside of that record to make a recommendation for a certain sanction, that distorts the record, and it becomes a liability if that decision is appealed to the Court of Appeals. And so that was the primary concern from the appellate attorneys, is the counsel's decision needs to be based on that record. And kind of a smaller issue with that, too, is while frequently we'll see officers request a copy of the investigative report, but that doesn't necessarily happen all the time. And so if you have an officer who shows up, who appears before you and has not requested his or her investigative file, and council members are reading that file and making decisions based on information in there that that person has not seen, they haven't really had a chance to address that or even hear that. And so I think that is also a kind of – that places us in a bad situation. I think part of the problem is there's just sort of a limitation with the system we have. And the way, as you know, this how this council operates is it issues – the council determines the what it deems as the appropriate sanction. But the fact-finding has been severed and kind of given over to the – is handled on the agency level, whether it's through an ALJ hearing or whether the respondent simply agrees with how Post sees the facts. And since that's severed, as we know, the respondent can come in and appear before the council and present mitigating information. Now, there's a distinction between that and the facts that support the allegation. And in that case, I think the council is fine to hear this mitigating evidence as long as it is not re-arguing the facts related to the allegation. However, so in a sense, you can take facts, you can take or receive mitigating facts, but since you're not a fact-finding agency, you can't necessarily – the members should not be necessarily initiating questions that aren't, you know, on information, on evidence that they don't have. I mean, I think follow-up questions and clarification questions are fair game. If, say, you have an officer who comes in, and kind of the one example I think of is if an officer comes in and says, well, I went through a rehab program, like an alcohol rehab program or something. I think the council can hear that and consider that as far as how you give out a sanction. I think it's fair to ask follow-up questions, and if you have clarification questions about that, I think those are fair game. But since that fact isn't necessarily up until that has not been part of the administrative record below, I don't know. I would recommend that the council members not like initiate that question, if that makes sense. You can hear what they bring in, but we shouldn't. But I recommend we not start kind of new lines of facts that we don't already have. And I think really what it comes down to is just sort of a relationship of trust between the council and the Post agency. I mean, Post's responsibility is to get you the facts that are going to help you make your decision about the appropriate sanction. And so it does require a little bit of trust since the administrative proceeding has been severed. The fact finding has been kind of severed from the sanction part of it. And so it does require a little bit of trust that Post will get you the necessary information. And along those lines, we are currently revising a few of the documents, such as the hearing waiver, and we'll probably take a look at the notice as well, making sure that when officers and dispatchers receive a notice of agency action and they have the option of signing a hearing waiver, that we make sure the language is clear about what they can expect, what they're allowed to do when they show up at the council to address the council, and just kind of make sure we have a really good explanation of the process in place. So with that, are there any questions?
Questions from the council? I think the issue arose, Mr. Bolander, as you recall, at times, as the cases are presented, additional questions come to mind of the council members that we feel, or at least the individual asking the question feels, is pertinent as to how they're going to vote on an issue. I don't think there's ever been a matter of distrust on the Post staff. I don't think that goes to it.
Yeah, not that I was implying there wasn't any, but I was just...
I understand that. But I think that there has been sometimes where we felt that we just needed additional clarifying information. So would it be appropriate to ask those questions as post staff is presenting the case, or are you recommending we not even go that far?
I guess it kind of depends on what kind of clarifying questions can...
It's going to depend on the case.
Yeah, and again, I think it's going to be really situational. Again, I think clarifying questions, if you see something in the pleadings that kind of raises a question, I think a clarifying question to flesh that out is, but again, it's not really a hard line. It's kind of a spectrum. I think there are certain clarifying questions that are obviously okay, but then you start kind of going towards more toward a line of questioning that would be, yeah, a little bit more questionable.
Okay.
Maybe I can throw out an example. Sure. If somebody is before the council and they, it's DUI, for example, and the council asking the question, have you attended rehab? Well, now you're soliciting more information than has been volunteered either in the report or by the officer. Is that a safe example?
I think the question should be record-based. Like, the question should have a basis based on the record before you. Questions that, like, aren't addressed at all in the record, I think, are questions that are most likely going to be, that should be off limits. Because, again, it goes back to the issue that your decision needs to be based on the administrative record.
Given the example that Director Stevenson just mentioned, there's been times when we've had officers here who are representing themselves, and they're extremely nervous. And they make their presentation to us, and it's apparent to somebody that they have neglected to mention something, such as I've attended a alcohol rehab. So in fairness, I think the council wants to ask that question to give that individual the opportunity to show what type of steps they're taking that could be considered a mitigating circumstance that post staff doesn't know about because it occurred after they completed their investigation.
Well, maybe perhaps, I don't know if you could ask that question for them, but I think a certain line of questioning, like, is there anything else that you think, you know, the council should be aware of, or is there anything that you believe that the council should consider that may mitigate whatever possible sanction we give them? I mean, I think that may give kind of that opportunity you're looking for, and a chance for them to kind of just step back for a quick second and think, is there anything else I want to bring up that may be useful?
Sheriff Edmonds.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but help me understand this whole notion of what is and is not the record, okay, as it relates to these administrative matters. In criminal proceedings, when this body makes it adjudicates these cases, okay? Mm-hmm. In criminal proceedings, the record is set, but all of the reports that a peace officer would put together would be part of that permanent record, and a magistrate will take it and have access to all of that. Okay, as well as both sides, the defense and the prosecution. In administrative matters, as a sheriff, as a chief executive officer, I have access to all of the information when I make administrative decisions at my agency. I'm just a little bit perplexed, and again, help me understand why this body that's making an adjudicatory decision would not have full access to all of the reports and all of the information. I'm not connecting the dots there.
I think the issue is this administrative proceeding has been set up where the fact finding has been severed from the sanction issuing. The administrative record that is set up for a disciplinary matter is either set up one of two ways. It's either set up that there's an ALJ hearing where we have an ALJ. Here's all the evidence that posts have and whatever evidence that an officer has, considers all the evidence, and then makes his or her findings of facts. Those facts become what the record is. And so, again, so I think your answer is the reason the council members don't have access to all the different files and reports that may be out there is because that fact-finding was done at the hearing level, either through an ALJ hearing or the officer just decides to either default or sign a hearing waiver saying, I agree with all the facts as Post alleges them, and so I'm not going to contest it. And that becomes the record. And so since the fact-finding part of the proceeding is not with the council, that is why you're not seeing all those records as you normally would, say at your agency, or like even in a criminal proceeding where a judge would have access to. And even then, the judge has access to the information that's presented to him or her.
That's right. But he would have access to everything that's part of the initial permanent record of a criminal proceeding would include all of the reports, all of the information that's gathered. There would be nothing that a judge wouldn't be able to get his or her hands on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm assuming it's entered into evidence. Yes.
Well, right. Yeah. We're making that supposition.
Yeah.
It seems to me it's putting this council at a distinct disadvantage if we're making an adjudicatory decision to not have the ability to have access to all of the information. I understand what you're saying about the ALJ, but is it true that every case goes before an ALJ?
No, most of them don't.
That's my understanding. So what about in those cases where there is not an ALJ, where there is not this finding of fact? What about then?
Well, then at that point, the administrative record is limited to the pleadings, which would be the post-notice of agency action, as the facts are stated in there. And then by law, of course, the officer is able to have the head of his or her agency submit a letter on their behalf. But that would be the record that comes before you. That is what the administrative record is at that point.
So even when there's not an ALJ hearing, this council would not, according to your legal opinion, they would not have access to the entire record.
That is correct.
I'm going to have to. I don't like it. It's an unknown animal to me. I will tell you that. I don't understand it.
Well, and I see where you're coming from. I mean, especially as you're trying to make, decision that profoundly impacts somebody's career, and then you're being told you're limited to like, five pages worth of stuff. And I get that, but again, it goes to setting up a proper record. And I'm also looking at it from the perspective, and from what I've seen in my short time here, there haven't been very many appeals of the post-council's decisions, but part of it, too, is the process that makes sure that our record is solid and that everything we use, that this council used for their record, to make their decision, and everything Post used for their allegations is supported on record. Yes?
Just so the sheriff doesn't think he's out there by himself, to me what you told me is that facts are irrelevant. That if we have a question about something, that everything that led up to the recommendation is out of our purview. And sometimes decisions need more information to be just, otherwise we're just rubber stamping whatever comes before this council.
I think that's very well said. These are grave decisions that we're making here. They affect lives. They affect lives not only the peace officers that come before us and the dispatchers, but also their families, extended families. The fact that we would not have access to the entire record when we're making such grave decisions is very troubling to me.
And it seems that once the information is submitted by staff to the director, that is the record that the post staff then takes to an ALJ. They get a letter of relinquishment, whatever they're going to do. But that information is already in the record. So by coming to us, we're not getting anything additional than what that decision was predicated on.
Well, you're not. Well, again, I think there's a distinction though between like the official administrative record versus information that Post has in its agency file. And part of that too is sometimes there are facts or things in those files that simply aren't relevant to the issue before the council. And I think, again, it's an issue of the information that's sitting in the division file isn't necessarily part of the administrative record.
If it goes to the ALJ, it is.
No, I mean, the actual investigative report itself isn't. Like, obviously, information off that maybe because, yeah, in a hearing, you know, Post will call witnesses that, you know, Post interviewed to show up and testify and sometimes present documents and interviews and things like that. But it needs to make that step, though, from agency file to getting it on the record. And that's kind of my point is the council's decision should be based on facts that make it into the record.
For clarification, if an appeal is made from here, it goes to what, a district court?
Court of Appeals.
Okay, Court of Appeals. Would they actually review anything that we would not be reviewing so that they might make a different decision based on something we didn't have?
No, the issue is
your record would go as it was presented to us.
As an appellate court, they're not a fact-finding court. They just review your decision. Did the council get it right?
Okay, procedure.
And so they're not reviewing evidence. Now, I mean, it's possible, and what will happen, I mean, a person could appeal your decision arguing that Post got the facts wrong and the ALJ got the facts wrong. And what the court is going to do, it's going to look at the administrative record that the ALJ used, which is the information that Post presented in the hearing. And so even then, the Court of Appeals doesn't automatically get the investigative file. They're still using the same information that you receive.
Well, in no case would the appellate court get the investigative files, would they? Because all they're making a decision on is what the record says.
Exactly.
They're
just reviewing your decision.
Right. Well, what concerns me most is it's very difficult for us to make a decision if we don't have all the facts. And that's what concerns me most.
Maybe to kind of address your concern, is there instances or is there a lack of facts in the pleadings and orders that you're receiving that might help you?
I can't think of one off the hand, and that's why I'm a little bit perplexed as to why we're going this route in the first place. I was operating under the supposition that we had access to all of the information. And again, it's an unknown animal to me. In the 11 years that I've been a chief executive, whenever I make adjudicatory decisions administratively at my office, I have all of the facts in front of me. I operate under that same premise here. I certainly know that district court judges would never want to make decisions without having all of the information in front of them.
Of course, and I totally agree. It's just that district court judges are also fact finders as well. And that's kind of, again, the limitation. I mean, the choices, we continue how this council has operated, where we've separated the fact finding into a kind of an agency proceeding, and then it appears before you if the allegations are sustained to issue a sanction versus having to hear the whole matter yourselves.
We don't want to investigate the matter. I don't think the Post Council, and I know I'll speak for myself, I don't want to investigate the matter. Post has competent investigators, very capable. One of them actually used to be one of my investigators. I know how competent he is, and I suspect all of the same for the rest of them. But what I'm saying is I don't want to be limited because of the gravity of the decision that we're making here. I don't ever want to be limited in what information I'm given to make that decision. Like Donna indicated, we are not a rubber stamp group, and I've never believed for a one second that was the function of this board, and it's never even been suggested by anybody at Post. We are Post. The Post Council is Post. That's the way I've always looked at us. So again, I don't mean to belabor the point, and I don't mean to be argumentative, sir. I appreciate your expertise, and I appreciate you doing all of the research that you've done. I'm just having a hard time connecting the dots.
And there were, while I can't recall the specific cases, within the last 3 or 4 minutes, there were cases presented that the council had questioned to. I'd have to go back and listen to the recordings, because that's what brought this conversation up to begin with. I don't recall, but there were issues where we didn't feel we had enough information, and that's why you were tasked with researching this. But Dr. Checkitz?
Well, I would just like to make a statement that I recognize your what you're describing as being this council separate from POST, which is finding fact, and us rendering an opinion of what has been presented to us. To clarify, though, you're identifying that as someone comes and presents or interjects additional mitigating facts. To me, that suggests that we then have somewhat of an ability to question those facts, because I certainly could not have someone in good conscience come and present a fact as they see it if I do not believe it is a fact. For example, someone were to come in front of this council and say, I am not an addict. I believe I'm the only one here holding a doctorate degree and able to render that opinion. I have to therefore say, and you provide me some information that backs up that opinion. Otherwise, I think I fail with my fiduciary responsibility. And so, while I understand what you're saying, I don't believe it is necessary to open up an entire line of questioning. But if someone presents information that is therefore considered a fact, sort of need to know if it is a fact.
Exactly, and I think certainly someone presenting a fact like that, I mean, not only does this, do you assign, you know, give weight to whatever fact, you know, whatever mitigating circumstances they're bringing to you, but in that case, I think it is fair to ask them, well, you've mentioned this as a mitigating circumstance, you know, please clarify, you know, and I think at that point, those clarification questions or those kind of follow-up questions are certainly appropriate. Because at that point, it is the, you have a person coming and presenting an argument why you should reduce, you know, why you should reduce their sanction. And I think that's fair to question that and ask them where they're coming from with that.
Okay. Director Dellingham, did you have another comment? I'm sorry, then we'll go to Colonel Fuhrer. No, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Colonel?
Just so I know I'm on solid ground, Mr. Bolander, I understand that we have this short synopsis of what actually occurred, and I know in this council plenty of times there's been questions raised as far as more information, and we've been able to call up the experts who investigated this, where the record lies, which is in the brains of these individuals, these investigators. Is it still appropriate, because I plan on doing this in one of these cases, asking a follow-up question to one of the investigators who investigated one of these cases, more clarifying questions. Can we dive into the knowledge of their investigation and ask clarified questions of them? Or are we just contained to this record on paper?
It really depends on the question. I'd be pretty cautious with that. I mean, if you have clarifying questions about...
on this case. So stop me if I'm...
The answer is maybe.
Okay.
I mean...
I guess we'll see.
Yeah.
Under that. Are we only to hear mitigating factors? Or are we to hear aggravating factors as well?
You know, it's kind of interesting because we don't hear a lot of, POST typically hasn't, at least in the meetings I've seen, POST hasn't really presented aggravating factors, like got up and said, well, here are the aggravating factors for this.
Yes, they have, quite frequently.
We have gotten away from, remember that old plus one, minus one?
Mm-hmm.
We've gotten away from that and looked at the totality of the circumstances. That's why I no longer say, here are the mitigating, here are the aggravating situations of this case. We stopped that practice several meetings ago because it was kind of convoluting the entire process, one plus one, and we have an officer say, well, I did this good.
Right.
I should be,
I understand the complexity of that, I do. But I guess what I heard our counsel say is that we were going to hear mitigating circumstances. There are cases, and I can think of many over the years that I've sat on this council, that there have been aggravating factors. People from the crowd wanted to come up and address on concerning aggravating matters. So I guess that's the question I have. Are we not hearing the aggravators anymore?
Well, the statute allows the officer to appear, you know, with their counsel and address the counsel, and it leaves it kind of open. But I think.
That notice you have has all the information that we have used to come up with a determination within those guidelines. If it's germane to that decision, is in the notice. And that's part of the fact-finding mission that we are tasked with. Mm-hmm. So I know that the word trust has been thrown out there. And I'm not saying that we have not been trusted, but I understand the discomfort with not having accessibility to all the information. But everything that we use is in that notice to come up with that determination, that recommendation.
Director Stevens, I would just note, too, that we have had some cases where it may not have been presented as aggravating, but, for example, there was a discrepancy between what the suggested discipline was for one officer as opposed to the other. For example, a DUI where a blood alcohol level was substantially higher and there was an explanation provided as to why that the sanction was suggested as being different than an alternative. So I think there's been some.
And Director, I would say that it's not an issue of trust, but independently thinking, I have had side counsel or side conversations with individuals where what we discussed the same issue and one thought it was mitigating and I thought maybe it wasn't. And it's an issue of not trust, but just experience and level that you assign to that same information based on all of our individual experiences.
And I would say, Sheriff, that's what you vote on. Whether you think it's a mitigator and the colonel thinks it's an aggravator, that's what spurns your which way you vote.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Belender?
So are we just, as we move forward,
Go ahead.
Am I recognized, Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Sure.
Robert's rules have never,
I know. I'm used to you.
Sorry. So are we just going to look to you then, sir, as our counsel, to direct us on how we're to answer questions or redirect or anything like that? Is that the way we're doing this?
Yes, I'll be paying attention.
Okay, we're going to hold you to that.
Thank you, sir.
Lieutenant Acosta?
I would just like to ask the council, what additional information would you like to see? And then we can talk with council to find out if that's appropriate information to be putting in a notice. Because there seems to be, occasionally there's the question, what happened here? Why are this guy getting this information? So as the Bureau Chief of Investigations, I'd like to know what council is suggesting that we do additionally that would provide you additional information to make your decision.
Well, I think the director just told us that every piece of information that you have to make your decision is contained in those.
It is.
Then what are we talking about? That's I'm not the sharpest guy in the room, but what are we talking about? If every piece of information that you have to make this decision is contained in the information we're getting, then why are we even having this conversation?
I think it's because, Sheriff, that at times it's been in a synopsis format,
right?
And there were just other questions about some of the underlying facts that perhaps led to the conclusion contained in the investigator's report. So. Again, I can't give you specifics. I know there's been questions throughout the years. This is not a new phenomenon, Mr. Bolander. Last time I was on the council years ago, this was an issue then. So perhaps in response to your question, what we need to do is when we have questions where we feel we need more information, that we're probably not going to get it during that meeting, but that we get with either Director Stevenson or Lieutenant Acosta and let them know we'd like to see this type of information contained in that agency report from Post. Fair enough? Any other questions for Mr. Bolander, who desperately wants to leave the podium?
How can you tell?
Thank you, sir. All right. Next is a report on in-service training hours by Deputy Director Sparks.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, council members. I'm not sure that I want to come to the podium anymore than Mr. Bolander wanted to leave. I want to give you just a quick report on the post in-service training audit for the training year that ended June 30th of 2013. There were 8,862 officers in that audit, and from that number, there are 52 who remained deficient in their training for the past year. All of those officers have been issued a letter instructing them or notifying them that their peace officer authority has been suspended until that deficiency is made up. Those officers who are still deficient on October 1st of this year will be reported to the Utah Retirement System. We've continued to make good progress in automating this audit, which has made it beneficial both for our staff and for those agencies who report to us. Any questions about the training audit?
I don't see any, Kelly.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I'll move on with the report on the voluntary relinquishment. From the last council meeting, we were requested to provide some statistics on the standing of the voluntary relinquishments in the state. In 2010, the legislature passed State Code 536211.5, which for the first time authorized peace officers to voluntarily relinquish their certification when a disciplinary matter had been reported to post. The following year, in 2011, a similar law was passed for certified dispatchers. Since those two laws were passed, 54 post certifications have been relinquished, 36 of those being from law enforcement officers, 13 correctional officers, 3 special functions officers, and 2 dispatchers have voluntarily relinquished their post certification. In 2010, there were 8 relinquishments. In 2011, there were 11 relinquishments. In 2012, 18. And so far this year, we are at 17 voluntary relinquishments. I've handed out a sheet which shows the allegations that were referred to post, which prompted those voluntary relinquishments. And I would also mention that in some cases, the relinquishment comes early in the process. But in many other cases, we've had to conduct a complete investigation, present that to the officer before we've obtained a relinquishment.
And just for a point of clarification, once a certification is relinquished, that's a life relinquishment. There's no possible way of obtaining a law enforcement certification in Utah again.
That's correct. It is, by all circumstances, equal to revocation. Is a lifelong prohibition against certification. They would not be eligible for certification again, and their names would also be reported on the National Decertification Database.
Very good.
Also, just to remind the council that once we receive that voluntary relinquishment, our investigation stops.
Makes sense.
Great. That's just what. Oh, I'm sorry, Director Dillian.
Would there be any way to get the population for these years? So I'd like to see we've over double the number of relinquishments. And so, what is the population we were dealing with in law enforcement at that time?
Would you like the population of the number of officers or of the
cases that are brought before the post council?
Of officers.
Basically, certification, classification, special sure. function, dispatch.
Yeah, we can produce that.
Great.
Yeah, I think that's probably more germane, is how many investigations or how many things have been referred to post, how many of those end up going to relinquishment, how many end up coming before the council. And we will provide that. We usually provide that on an annual basis as part of our annual report, but we can certainly provide it at the next meeting as well.
Right. Any other questions for Deputy Director Sparks? I see none. Thank you. This is what we asked for. I appreciate it. All right. Next will be a post-investigative status report by Lieutenant Acosta.
Good afternoon, members of council. What I'd like to do is just talk to you a little bit about what we've been receiving since the June 5th, 2013 council. Investigations Bureau has received a total of 60 complaints. Of those 60 complaints, we have had 41 that actually went to investigations. We have had 2 administrative law judge hearings, both of which were founded in our favor. We have a total of 5 cases that were closed with no action taken. We investigated and found that there was not enough information to take any action on their certification. We have had 8 of the voluntary relinquishments, and allegations of regarding those were 1 for aggravated assault, or two cases for aggravated assault. There was a fitness for duty, sexual conduct on duty. There was 3, theft and fraud. There was 1, and assault. So we have a variety of different things that we've done. The Investigations Bureau has completed over 300 background investigations. So of those 300, they are cases that we receive from all satellite academies, to include the ones that are attending corrections and our academy there in Sandy. Active investigations, we currently have 65 that are open, and or 65 cases, but we have 120 cases that are either in some type of hearing. They're either getting ready to go to a hearing. Letters have been sent out to the officers, and we're waiting for them to send back either hearing waivers or ask for an ALJ hearing. So that's what we've completed so far and what we've done. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Acosta. Are there any questions for Lieutenant Acosta before he gets too far away? Okay. Next will be disciplinary cases presented by Director Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair, Counsel. Okay, the first case involves Officer Jaron Anderson with the Utah Department of Corrections. The offense category is fishing without a valid license, valid wildlife license. This is a Category E. We're proposing a letter of caution. A waiver has been signed. On May 4th, 2013, Jaron Anderson was fishing at Lake Powell. While fishing at Anderson was contacted by a police officer who asked to see Anderson's fishing license. Anderson gave the officer his license. The officer found that the license had expired. Anderson received a citation for fishing without a license, a Class B misdemeanor. During the Garrity interview, he was forthright. That's all I have.
All right. Is Mr. Anderson, our representative here today, like to speak to this case? Step up to the podium, sir.
On this, I was fishing down at Lake Powell. When he pulled me over, looked at my license, it was expired by, I believe it was 1 month. The day before I had left, I'd went down and bought my wife a ticket, or a license. She went with me, and it was like 2 months earlier before that I had put in on the big game draws. This has to be valid to put in on this draw, and I just assumed, I guess, that it was good through further than that. If I would have known, I would have purchased the license at the same time I did my wife's. Are there any questions I can answer for the council?
All right, Mr. Anderson, thank you. We'll bring back to the council for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I need to recuse myself.
Can Director Cook will recuse himself?
I move to accept the recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
This next case involves Lieutenant Ron Lance with the South Salt Lake Police Department. It's a BCI violation, which is a Category E. We're recommending a letter of caution, which is signed under waiver. On August 18, 2010, Ron Lance ran a criminal history check on a man he believed to be a danger to his family. In 2011, a BCI audit revealed
that the criminal history check was made without a case number attached. When Ron Lance recalled the incident, he reported his mistake to his supervisor. BCI was notified, and Lance was given a letter of reprimand by his supervisor. On April 3rd, 2013, the agency became aware of this incident and he reported it to Post. Post opened the investigation, and Mr. Lance was forthright during his Garrity interview.
Questions of Director Stevenson? Mr. Lance, or legal counsel here today?
I am.
Come on up to the podium, please.
After your discussion, I'm not 100% sure what to say other than I'm thoroughly embarrassed, but I truthfully did not do this with malicious intent or deviant intent. I truthfully believed that my daughter was in some danger. There are people in this room that I know and I respect, and it's embarrassing, but I think it's important. I brought my son. I constantly preach to stand up for what happens to you, whether it's good or bad. Be truthful and forthright. And I brought him here today as support for me, but more than that, to see me do what I constantly preach. I'm embarrassed for my department. I truly respect my administration, and I feel guilty for putting them in the limelight as well as my family. I can answer any questions you want. I don't know what else to say.
Okay, we have a letter in your packet from Chief Snyder, South Salt Lake Police Department. Any questions for Mr. Lance?
I just have a quick one.
Sure.
Mr. Lance, what are you hoping to get? Did you just want to come in here and address us, or is there something you're looking for us to do? I'm not exactly clear.
The way I look at it is what it is. I ran the guy. There's no argument there. I showed up today because I think it is my duty to stand before you and take whatever it is. I don't want to shuck this in any way. I want to be an example to my son. And that's why I'm here today. I'm not here to try to sway your decision. I really haven't even looked at this letter. So that's why I'm here.
Well, I appreciate your candor, and you seem like an honorable man, and you seem like a good father, too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Lance? Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Director Stevenson, any additional?
If I just add that all Mr. Lance had to do was submit a case number. He was perfectly legitimate in his purposes for accessing BCI, just failed to draw a case number from that. So that's why our recommendation is a letter of caution.
All right. Thank you, Director. Back to the council for discussion or a motion. Colonel Fuhrer.
Discussion. This is a new law. I know that he wasn't criminally charged, but this is a new law, and there's kind of a slippery slope right here where a lot of times it's hard for a police officer to figure out what he's doing right or what he's doing wrong, he or she. So I appreciate the candor of this individual and taking his lumps. At the same time, we recognize in law enforcement that this is a new law, although he wasn't charged, and it's going to take some time to figure this whole thing out.
Yeah. I'll wait till after the vote.
All right.
I'll make a motion to accept the recommendation of letter of caution.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have any other discussion prior to the motion? Okay. Do we have a second? Director Dillingham? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you, Mr. Lance. We appreciate your candor today.
In light of these last two cases, if you remember, I came to you and asked for your approval to add another category, which broke up the Class B misdemeanor category. Under the old guidelines, this would have been a year for, you know, a misstep. So I appreciate your approval on that. That's been huge in allowing us to decipher, especially with the new law, with accessing BCI. Man, that's a stiff penalty when you had a legitimate purpose to run it, just failed to submit or ask for a case number. So I appreciate the council for doing that. Okay, next case. Next case involves Jeffrey R. Bigler, formerly with the Ohio Patrol. The offense category is a BCI violation. Actually, still employed, sorry. BCI violation of the category E. We're recommending a 6-month suspension. This is under signed waiver. On January 15, 2012, Jeffrey Bigler accessed the Bureau of Criminal Identification and the Utah Criminal Justice Information System for personal reasons. On January 31, 2012, the BCI Terminal Access Coordinator, or TAC, conducted an audit of the system where the illegal access was identified. During a department internal investigation, Bigler admitted he accessed the system to acquire information about his ex-wife's location. Bigler was charged criminally with unlawful access or use of a criminal investigations and technical services division's records, Class B misdemeanor. He pled to a reduced charge of Class C misdemeanor.
Questions for Director Stevenson? Is Mr. Bigler or legal counsel here today? Okay, back to you, Director.
Again, this you can see the difference in the two cases. This was strictly for personal reasons.
Okay, back to the council for discussion and or motion.
I'll make a motion that we accept the 6-month suspension.
Okay, the motion by Sheriff Tracy.
Seconded by Sheriff Smith. Excuse me. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
I'll recuse myself.
Pardon?
I'm recusing myself.
All right. Thank you, Colonel.
Next case involves Jason R. Webb, Utah Department of Corrections. The offense category is DUI, impaired driving, which is a category D. I'm recommending a 1-year suspension under default. On October 6, 2012, Mr. Webb, a correctional officer with the Utah Department of Corrections, was stopped for speeding. The officer detected the odor of alcohol and believed Webb was possibly under the influence. After Webb failed this standardized field sobriety tests, it was determined he was impaired and was not safe to operate a motor vehicle. Webb was placed under arrest and submitted to a chemical test, which indicated a breath alcohol level of 0.10.
Questions for Director Stevenson? Is Mr. Webb here today, our legal counsel? Anything else, Director?
No, sir.
Okay. Counsel? Okay, Mr. Coates recusing himself.
Move to accept post recommendation.
Motion by Sheriff Edmonds.
Second.
Second by Robbie. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Next case, Commissioner, or Director.
That was a quick promotion.
Yeah, it is. Sorry, Commissioner.
I'll take the pay without the responsibility.
Well, you've already lost your hair, so that's a prerequisite of the job, I think.
You won't see me age. Next case involves Clint Brandon Downs, formerly with Utah Department of Corrections, has since retired. Offense category is disorderly conduct, electronic harassment, category D and F. I'm recommending a 1-year suspension signed under waiver. On June 28, 2012, Brandon Downs sent a text message threatening physical harm to a man who was having an affair with Downs' wife. On July 2, 2012, Downs went to his wife's place of employment and initiated a verbal argument with his wife in the parking lot. Downs' wife reported both incidents to police, and Downs was charged with disorderly conduct and infraction for this incident. Downs entered into a plea in abeyance to disorderly conduct and infraction.
Any questions for the director? Is Mr. Downs here today or legal counsel? No. Okay, back to Director Stevenson. Nothing else?
Nothing more.
Okay. Counsel?
That needs to be recused.
Okay. Mr. Cook is recused.
Move to accept the recommendation.
Motion by Sheriff Smith to accept.
Second.
Second by we'll see. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. Next case involves Wesley L. Irvin, formerly with Layton City Police Department. Category offense is driving under the influence, which is a Category D. We're recommending an 18-month suspension, which is signed under waiver. On May 5th, 2013, Wesley Irvin was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol. Irvin was initially stopped by police for making an illegal turn. Irvin performed the standardized field sobriety test, which indicated he was impaired. After Irvin's arrest, he submitted to an intoxilizer test, which showed a breath alcohol content of 0.178. Irvin entered a plea in abeyance to amend a charge of impaired driving, which is a Class B misdemeanor.
Any questions for Director Stevenson? I'm going to recuse myself, even though I don't vote. Mr. Irvin, Mr. Rawson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, good afternoon. I'm Attorney Brett Rawson on behalf of my client, Wes Irvin. Mr. Irvin lost his job as a result of this incident. I'm providing you with two pieces of information, which is circulating right now. The director is correct. The disposition of this case was a plea of guilty to a lesser charge of impaired driving. That plea is held in abeyance. The court ordered that he participate in counseling in a 16-hour program, which he did complete. I'll make reference to the fact that Mr. Irvin also completed another course before the court made its order, and then come to find out it was not a court-authorized program. And consequently, he went back and did it again per the court's requirement as part of his plea in abeyance. The other document that I'm circulating is one that I have provided to you before. It's a list, and it's a list as inclusive as we could make it from records from Post relating the BAC and additional facts relative to a charge of driving under the influence for a number of officers going back a couple of years, including one that I was here before the council on just in March of this year here in St. George. You'll notice that the BAC in that case from March and today's case are within one thousandth of a percentage point, 0.177 compared to 0.178. The council has followed the recommendation most of the time, but the average has been 12 months, even in consideration of higher BACs. Our request today is that the council be consistent with what it did in March on facts that are substantially similar. The difference being that in the criminal system, Mr. Irvin did receive a more favorable outcome. But the facts giving rise to it are similar in that there was not an accident. My client would like to address the council.
Thank you. First of all, I'd just like to apologize for the position that I put myself in. And, you know, I was just listening to the gentleman earlier as the same as me. You know, I preach this to my children and try and, you know, raise them up to be respectful and, you know, do things right. And, you know, I've been a police officer for in law enforcement for close to 18 years and really enjoyed doing that type of work and being someone respected and people coming to me for advice. And to put myself in this position has been very embarrassing, and I just, you know, deserve the consequences that I get and just want to try and get my life back in order.
We believe that a one-year suspension will give him the opportunity that he needs to, in fact, put his career back together, his life back together, and return to law enforcement, which is his intention to finish off his last 2 years. And if you have any questions, we're happy to take those.
Questions from counsel? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Irvin. Director Stevenson?
I have nothing to add.
Okay, back to the council. Discussion or a motion? Sheriff?
I think counsel made a fairly compelling argument regarding consistency. I would make the motion that we reject Post's recommendation of 18 months and go with a 12-month suspension.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion on the motions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Two. Dr. Checkitz and Sheriff Smith. Anybody else? Opposed? Just the two. Is that correct, John? All right.
Passes with seven.
Okay, 12 months.
Okay, the next case involves Todd R. Nielsen with the Utah Transit Authority, since been terminated. Category offense is DUI open container. Category D, our recommendation is 18-month suspension under default. On January 26, 2013, Todd Nielsen was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol, open container, and speeding. The investigating officer report indicated Nielsen refused any and all field sobriety tests, and a warrant was obtained to draw his blood. Blood results indicating an alcohol level of 0.09. On February 21st, 2013, Nielsen was terminated by his employee and agency. On May 6th, he entered a guilty plea to an amended charge of reckless driving.
Questions for Director Stevenson? Is Mr. Nielsen here today, legal counsel? No? Okay, back to counsel.
Is it my understanding that he refused to feel sobriety?
Yes. They had to get a warrant to draw the blood.
Do we have a motion?
Motion to accept 18 months.
Okay.
Second.
By Colonel Peter and second by Sheriff Tracy. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Director. Next case involves Jose Ricardo Rosales with the Weber State Satellite Academy. Category offense is Category C, falsifying information to obtain certification, recommending a 2-year suspension under signed waiver. On April 17, 2013, Post received information from a local police agency regarding Jose Rosales, a cadet at the Satellite Academy. Rosales had submitted an application with the agency and disclosed many criminal violations that were not disclosed on the original Post application. On April 18th, an investigation was opened, and on April 25th, Post conducted a Garrity interview with Rosales where he admitted to omitting information from his application. He has since withdrawn from the academy.
Is Mr. Rosales here? Sir, would you like to address the council?
Here's my letter. It's unfortunate that I have to be here, but here I am. I did, when I was applying for St. George PD, I did disclose some things with them that I didn't write on my Post application. And some of those things were like some theft, which I'm really ashamed of. Just working after my manager, you know, offered me a job to work for him. I have learned a lot from this experience. Another one was a burglary. you know, I was goofing around and broke into my former roommate's apartment. And at the time, I wasn't thinking of it as a crime. I was just goofing around. And thefts of services, I mess around with the cable box in one of my apartment where I used to live in. I said, hey, maybe I'll get some free cable or something, and I hooked it up, and I did. And I'm really sorry for, I'm ashamed of myself. I know in the letter that I received, it said that I willfully falsified documents in my post application to obtain certification. And that's probably the reason that I'm here. Because I know that I did not want to deceive anybody into getting my certification. When I filled out my post application, I filled it as best as I could. And when I started filling out applications for other agencies, when I started filling it out for St. George, the background packet had more specific questions that jogged my memory more. And that's why I disclosed those things there. I believe that if I would have gotten the same packet for my post application, I would have written the same thing. It's been a hard year. This is something that I really wanted to do, and I put a lot of work. We put all my chips into it, even borrowed ones. And I'm just here to plead with the council that may lessen the recommended suspension they have for me. I don't deny the things I did. I was younger and I thought differently. I've been able to work in, you know, financial institutions where I've been in charge and responsible for the vault and large amounts of money, and the thought of stealing or desire has never even crossed my thought. I'm not a perfect individual, but I do try to be better every day. I know I wasn't perfect then, but I know I'm better now than I was before, and that's why I'm here. If you guys have any questions, you're more than welcome to ask.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Rosales? Sheriff Tracy?
How long ago was this incident with the cable?
That was 4 years ago. And then the other ones were 8 years ago.
Any other questions? Anything else you'd like the council to consider, Mr. Rosales?
Well, I just want to let you know that I would be a great peace officer, and I'm still wanting to finish what I started.
Keep that in mind. All right. Thank you. Director Stevenson?
I've been a bit.
Okay. Council?
I have a question for Director Stevenson.
Colonel?
Director, is the post application and the St. George Police Department application that different in the wording of what they need to disclose?
From what you're investigating? Without having to look at the St. George application, I can't answer that.
When the investigators investigated this, were they able to find discrepancies, but as it was just articulated that there was a difference in what needs to be disclosed?
The charge was not even included in the original post application. They're that different? Want to address it?
The application for St. George's is extremely specific. It gives specific questions. It's a lot thicker than post. So there were specific questions on that that must have triggered some of the things that he admitted to. Although post is a little bit general, it still does say, are you involved in, have you been arrested for, or have you been convicted of any of the crimes falling within those categories. So some of those items, even though that they're general in nature, those should have rose to his attention as something he should have admitted to, but didn't.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll entertain a motion.
Would you accept Post's recommendation?
Okay, a motion from Sheriff Edmonds to accept.
I'll second.
Second from Mr. Cook. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Next case involves Nate Costa, formerly with Salt County Sheriff's Office. Category is B, criminal trespassing in a dwelling. Recommending a 3-year suspension. This is a signed waiver. On September 15, 2011, Nate Costa, a correctional officer with the Salt County Sheriff's Office, unlawfully entered the home of a female co-worker when she was not home. Costa used a credit card to unlock a side door and gain entry into the home, where he remained until the next morning. The co-worker reported the break-in by Costa to Sandy City Police Department, in which Costa was cited. On October 28, 2011, he entered a guilty plea of criminal trespass, a Class B misdemeanor.
Questions for Director Stevenson?
Yes. It states on here that this was an invitation to her home. On that day.
I'll turn that over to the investigator.
Yeah, during the investigation, it was disclosed that they had made some kind of an arrangement to get together. He arrived at the house and she wasn't there. And when she didn't show, he opted to go in the house and hang out.
But she did invite him to her house.
She invited him over so that they could do something together, but when she wasn't, she was at a party or something, she didn't answer the phone when he got there, and it was obvious that no one was home, but he still chose to enter the house and stay. She never even returned that night.
Director?
Get ready to vote. I need to recuse myself. I was actually the chief of corrections at that time.
All right, sir. Okay, bring it to the council for a motion.
Is he here?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, is Mr. Costa here? Thank you, Lamont. Okay, now to the council for a motion. Do we have a second?
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Next case involves Scott Harper, formerly with Davis County Sheriff's Office, Category A, misuse of prescription drugs, recommending a 3-year suspension. This is a signed waiver. On February 2nd, 2013, Scott Harper attempted suicide by taking several Lortab and morphine pills that were not prescribed to him. After taking the pills, Harper called 911 to report his suicide attempt and asked that medical personnel respond to transport him to the hospital. Harper was admitted to the mental health division of the hospital and was later released. Harper attended therapy with a mental health doctor. The doctor who treated Harper feels Harper is no longer a danger to himself. There was never a determination if Harper was fit for duty.
Questions of Director Stevenson? Dr. Checkets?
Why was there never a
He resigned before an IA could be conducted, and we can't compel somebody to do a fitness for duty evaluation. So there's nobody to compel him to take one.
Any other questions? All right, we'll bring it back to Dr.
So we post could not recommend the category G in this case.
No.
It's a violation of law. That category is used when somebody is deemed unfit or before they have broken the law.
Any other discussion or questions? All right. Bring the council for a motion. I keep forgetting that, don't I? Mr. Harper, are you here? I don't recognize him here. No? All right. Now we'll bring it back to the council for a motion. Keep me honest.
I'll second that.
Okay, motion by Sheriff Tracy, motion seconded by Sheriff Smith. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Next case involves Adam Ray, formerly with Naples City Police Department, Category B, sexual conduct on duty. We're recommending a 3-year suspension, signed waiver. Between June 11th and November 2012, June 2011 and November. Between 2011 and 2012, Adam Ray was involved in an extramarital affair. In a meeting with an administrator, Ray admitted to engaging in oral sex with a female in his police vehicle and in uniform on multiple occasions.
Questions for Director? Is Mr. Ray our legal counsel here today? Okay, back to the council.
Motion to accept 3-year suspension.
Okay, motion to accept by Colonel Fuhrer.
Second.
I think he beat you this time, Robbie. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay, next case involves Andrew Bailey, formerly with Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office. Category G is a fitness for duty. Recommending an indefinite suspension. It's a signed waiver. On December 14, 2012, Andrew Bailey, a correctional officer with the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office, was terminated following a fitness for duty evaluation. The fitness for duty evaluation indicates the return to duty is not advised. This finding stems from an evaluation that produced evidence of impairments that would significantly interfere with his ability to discharge his duties.
Questions for Director Stevenson? Mr. Bailey, your legal counsel here today? Okay, back to the council. Motion to accept by Sheriff Smith.
I'll second.
Okay, seconded by Director Cook. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Director?
Next case involves Director Jay Monahan, formerly with Santa Quinn PD. Category A, theft and lying under Garrity. Recommend a revocation. This is under default. On November 23rd, 2012, Derek Monahan was seen by two city employees loading city-owned backhoe cutting blades designated as scrap metal onto his personal vehicle and trailer. The following day, Monahan sold 1,798 pounds of steel to a local scrap metal company. On December 11, 2012, after a Garrity warning, Monahan denied the theft, stating the city-owned scrap metal was only used to protect his trailer. Then he returned the metal where he found it. The scrap metal was never located. Monahan submitted to a polygraph examination, which indicated he was deceptive regarding the theft and sale of the scrap metal. On January 8, 2013, Monahan was terminated. Criminal charges were not pursued.
Questions for Director Stevenson? Mr. Monahan, our legal counsel here today? All right, back to the council for a motion or discussion.
Motion to accept revocation.
Motion by Colonel Fuhrer to accept.
Second.
Second by Robbie. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Director, go ahead.
Next case involves Corey C. Staley, formerly with Summit County Sheriff's Office. Category A, child abuse. Recommending a revocation. This is under default.
On April 13, 2012, Corey Staley, a deputy sheriff with the Summit County Sheriff's Office, was investigated for child abuse. The parents of the 4-year-old victim alleged Staley choked their son while he was in Staley's care on April 12, 2012. The information was forwarded to the Summit County Sheriff's Office for further investigation. The Summit County Attorney's Office was assigned to conduct an investigation. Staley was interviewed and he admitted to choking the 4-year-old child. Charges were screened and filed by the Summit County Attorney's Office. On March 4, 2013, Staley entered a plea of guilty to an amended charge of child abuse, a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, sir. Any questions for Director Stevenson? Is Mr. Staley or legal counsel here today? Okay, back to the council.
I move to approve the revocation.
Okay. Moved to approve by Director Cook. Any second?
Second.
Sheriff Tracy, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Okay. Next case involves Tolly G. Ivey with the Department of Corrections. Category A, assault. This is a revocation signed under waiver. On June 10, 2012, Tolly Ivey, after consuming several alcoholic drinks, assaulted another individual while at a party. The victim suffered several facial fractures and a broken nose. On September 11, 2012, a department entered IA could sustain the allegation of unlawful conduct and unprofessional behavior. Ivey was suspended for 48 hours, 6 working days, without pay, and remained employed at the department. Ivey was convicted of assault, a Class B misdemeanor.
Questions of Director Stevenson? Mr. Ivey here today, or legal counsel? Sir, come on up to the podium, please.
First off, thanks for hearing me today. I just want to let you know I've been with the Department of Corrections for 13 years. I'm a lieutenant out there. In my career, I've not been in any trouble except for this one night that I had a mishap due to the individual that I got in an altercation with. I don't know if I can tell you why I got in an altercation with him, but I'm going to tell you, and if I can't, you'll tell me no. The reason why is the individual had cornered my wife in a tent and had forced himself upon her, under her clothes and above. When I found out this, I confronted the individual, and at that time, he took an aggressive step towards me and said, "Yes, I did. What are you going to do about it?" At that time, I just tried to distance myself from the individual and talked with him. He grabbed me. It happened to turn into an altercation. The minute that I was able to get away from him, I backed off and left. Again, this is just a unfortunate incident that he got the injuries that he sustained from that. You know, we're taught to go into a fight or flight mode, and I went into the fight mode until I was eligible to get away from him, and at what time I did. I made a bad decision on confronting the individual that night. If I could do it different, you know, I would have notified the local PD instead, but obviously there was some alcohol consumed that night. I have went to an evaluation to see if I have an alcohol problem, which comes back, they said I don't. It's been 15 months, and it goes across my mind every single day that I wish I could have done it different, but I just hope that you guys will give me an opportunity to finish my career with the Department of Corrections. I enjoy it. I look forward to going to work every single day. And unfortunately, I couldn't bring letters. I do have people at work that would vouch for my normal behavior. And I just hope that you can take into consideration that, you know, we're all human and we do some stupid stuff every now and then. And the night in question was definitely dumb, and If I could change it, I would. I can answer any questions you have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ivey. Questions for Mr. Ivey?
I've got one. Sure. Did your wife ever, did she press criminal charges against this assailant?
Yes, she did. Pace and PD said that they believed it was just a ploy, so they would not press any charges against him because they said they thought it was just a ploy so that I wouldn't get in trouble with you guys. So we took it to the Utah County Sheriff's. They come over and did a full investigation. Upon their investigation, unfortunately, they said because there was no physical marks, it just comes down to a he said, she said type thing. So at this point, they basically said they wasn't going to investigate any further because it just comes down to a he said, she said incident.
So the case was for you by a prosecuting authority?
Yes.
Specifically, Utah County Attorney's Office? Who screened the case?
The Utah County Sheriff's come and took the report, and they said they were turning it over to their attorneys.
They declined to prosecute?
Yeah. Because they said it comes down to a he said, she said, because there was no physical marks.
Can I ask another question? Based on what Sheriff Edmonds I talked about, was that assault on your wife the evening that you talked about, the going underneath
yes.
her clothes and on top of her clothes the same evening?
Yes.
As the assault, okay.
And it happened, I had left the residential area to run to the store with some other people. Of course, I wasn't driving. Upon returning, just moments after I got out of the car, my friend said, you need to find your wife. I traveled a short, maybe from here to the wall, and found my wife in my friend's backyard and asked her if this stuff had happened to her. And at that time, she started crying, shaking her head yes, and, you know, bad decision, drinking, trying to protect my wife. I approached Mr. Bird, which is up the same distance back to where I just been, and asked him if he had did it, and he stood up out of his chair and said, yes, I did. What are you going to do about it? And at that point, I just shoved him back down in his chair because there's a fire pit right behind me. Bad decision. I leaned over him to tell him what kind of piece of work he is, and at that point, he grabbed me, and that's when we went to blows.
Judging from what I'm hearing, there was no witnesses to your wife's assault.
No, it was in a tent. But there was another individual there at the party that he had tried to assault before my wife, that I found out after the fact.
Did the party see the assault?
No, it was in the tent, but they did. My wife talked to the other gal. And that's how they knew to inform me of it.
Any other questions for Mr. Ivey from the council? Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'd like to point out to the council there is a letter from the Department of Corrections attached to this file. Director Stevenson, we'll turn the time back to you.
If I may just clarify, we found no supporting evidence or facts to decipher whether she was assaulted or not.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Did the post investigators interview his wife?
No.
Did you try to talk to his wife?
No.
Was this brought up in the course of your investigation, the story of his wife being assaulted by the individual as well?
It was, and I obtained a police report from Payson regarding that. She made a report to police, but when the police arrived to take a report, she refused to cooperate and didn't want to talk about the incident.
Well, I'll give you time in just a minute, Mr. Ivey. Okay. Any other questions for Director Stevenson?
Just going through the difference between the, you know, why is this a level A? Is it based on the fact that there was an assault?
Yeah, violence. Class A misdemeanor with violence.
Level of damage?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Ivey, I'll give you a couple of minutes if you want to say something else to the council.
As far as my wife, with them saying the patient doesn't have a thing, Officer Shaw is the one that come to the house and talked to my wife. My wife wrote it out on the computer, her statement. My sister was present when Officer Shaw come and took that statement from my wife. If it's not in their file, then I do have a copy of that. But my wife did file a thing with Payson Police. My father-in-law, who retired as a police officer, worked many years in Payson. And he was quite disgusted that Payson had done nothing. So he went down and talked to Chief Runyon about this situation. And that's when we was informed that Payson wasn't going to do anything about it because they feel that she made that plea to keep me out of trouble, that she filed that.
All right. Do you have a copy of that letter with you today?
I don't, because I was instructed by Sergeant Lucas that I cannot bring anything here today that is not already in evidence.
Okay.
So I did not bring it with me.
All right.
But I could get you a copy of it. And I'm sure if you was to look at the Utah County Sheriff's, they would have a copy of the incident being reported to them also. So it was reported.
All right.
To them.
And just a reminder for the council members, since there was a hearing waiver assigned with this is a situation where the facts as stated in the notice of agency action is what we have the records as far as what happened that night. I mean, the evidence presented, I mean, in context of mitigating, but we have, as far as the actual facts about who did what, this is what we have in the notice, and that's what the council has to go off of.
Right. Can I ask one more question?
Go ahead, Chair.
You know, and this is a bold question, and it's not intended to offend you, but is there a reason your wife didn't come down with you today and maybe address the council?
Yeah, because my wife cannot even shop in Payson, because she is afraid to run into this guy in the stores. She cannot drive anywhere near his house because she's afraid to run into this guy. And I am not going to put her through to come up here and cry in front of you guys again. I just won't put her through it again.
Fair enough. And for clarification, according to the administrative rules, witnesses don't testify at this hearing. It's limited to the officer or their attorney who are allowed to speak to the council.
Has that always been the case?
No, but we had a case about a year and a half ago where that issue came up. And
because I know in the past we've done that.
Right. All right, Mr. Ivey, thank you.
One more thing. So I do hope that you guys will take into consideration what Department of Corrections that gave me the 6 days off without pay. They're investigators. I'm not saying that these ones haven't done a fine job, but they talked with all parties that was involved that evening, so I believe that they got a more full picture than these investigators. And I'm not trying to say that they didn't do it, but they did talk to my wife, and they did talk the corrections. Talked to my wife and the other lady that was that night also. So that's all. I just hope that we don't, you know, that you take that into consideration.
Right. And I'm sure the council will. Mr. Ivey, I'm sure you recognize as a law enforcement officer, we have to govern our actions both on and off duty.
I do know this.
And that's what we're addressing here today.
As
been pointed out by council. So I appreciate you coming and giving us your information. Thanks. Director Stevenson.
I could just remind the council,
Mr. Ivey signed a waiver forfeiting his due process rights and his opportunity to be heard before an administrative law judge.
Thank you. Questions for Director Stevenson from Council? Okay, bring it back to the Council for discussion and a motion.
Myself.
All right, Mr. Coates, please.
I'll make the motion that we accept the Post's recommendation of revocation.
I'll second that. We have a motion made by Sheriff Edmonds to accept and seconded by Sheriff Smith. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Director Stevenson.
Next case involves Luke M. Emack. Formerly with Beaver County Sheriff's Office. It's Category A, Attempted Aggravated Assault, DV. Is that a question? Okay, very good. Recommending revocation. This is under a signed waiver. On October 6, 2012, Luke M. Emack had an argument with his girlfriend at their home. As Emack was backing out of the garage in the couple's vehicle, the girlfriend threw a shoe at the vehicle. Emack's girlfriend walked past the front of the vehicle towards the interior door of the house. Emack put the vehicle in drive, spinning the tires as he jerked the vehicle forward. Emack's girlfriend jumped onto a step at the door of the home as Emack bumped into a toy horse at the rear of the garage. Emack then backed out of the garage and left the home. A neighbor called police after speaking with the girlfriend, who was upset about the incident. On October 10, 2012, Emack was arrested on felony aggravated assault charges and terminated from his department. On October 17, 2012, Emack entered a plea in abeyance to an amended charge of attempted aggravated assault, a Class A misdemeanor.
All right. Questions for Director Stevenson? Mr. Emack or counsel here today? Sir, would you like to approach the counsel?
I want to say thanks for letting me come here and talk. I apologize for being in this position, and I know what I did was pretty stupid. The night that it happened, we've been having issues for the last couple of days. I just found out she was cheating on me, and so we were talking about trying to figure out what to do. I came home. I took my boys out, come back, told her I just wanted to get out of the house, so I'm just going to leave for a bit. So I went and got in the car. She said I need to get my stuff out of the car, and I said, will you please hurry so I can leave? And she opened up the door, was sitting there talking, I said, please go. And she slammed the door and threw a shoe at the car. And yeah, I should have just left, I should have just backed out and left. But I waited till she was totally gone, clear up on the steps, weren't even coming close to her. I wasn't even wanting to hit her, weren't even coming close to her. Went right towards that, I spun the tires, went up about a foot and a half, maybe, if that. And I backed out calmly and left the residence. I don't know where it all came from about the neighbor being called, but it was actually her brother that called out. The police, they weren't even in the town. And she called them, called him and said to come pick her up so she could go to her parents' house. Like I said, I know it was stupid. It was a dumb thing for me to do. I cooperated fully with the sheriff's office, did exactly what they told me to do, went through whatever I had to go through. Currently, I've been taken care of, like we did a plea in abeyance. I took care of everything I needed to take care of. It ends up on October 6th to 1 year plea in abeyance. It's all gone off my record. I plead to a Class A. I'm not saying that some disciplinary action shouldn't be taken. I'll definitely take care of my responsibilities and do what I need to do. But permanent revocation, I see should carry. Yeah, any questions?
No questions. All right, thank you, Mr. Emack.
Thank you.
Director Stevenson?
I have nothing to add.
All right. Back to the council. Discussion and a motion.
Accept
Post's
recommendation.
All right, we have a motion to accept by Sheriff Edmonds.
I'll second it.
Second by Director Cook. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay, we have some that are abstaining apparently, so can we do this by a raise of hands? All in favor? Okay, all those opposed? All right. Got that, Sean? Thank you. Director Stevenson.
Okay, last case involves Christopher H. Basso, formerly with Carbon County SO. Category A, burglary, possession of controlled substance, and tampering with evidence. We recommend revocation. This is a signed waiver. On January 16, 2013, Basso was placed on administrative leave following two positive drug tests. On January 23, 2013, it was discovered Basso was entering his agency's evidence storage room after normal business hours. On January 24, 2013, a video surveillance camera was set up, and it recorded Basso tampering with drug evidence envelopes. During an IA Garrity interview, Basso admitted to taking methamphetamine from the evidence room and ingesting it. Basso was terminated and subsequently charged with burglary, possession of controlled substance, and tampering with evidence.
Any questions of Director Stevenson? Is Mr. Basso our legal representative here today? Okay, back to Director Stevenson.
Nothing to add.
Okay. To the council.
Move to
accept. I'll
set. Motion to accept. Sheriff Tracy, seconded by Sheriff Smith. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. That brings us to the end of the disciplinary record. The next on the agenda is proposed legislation. You'll notice there's two laws. The blue page in your packet contains the language of the law. Director Stevenson.
536208, inactive certificates, which also includes lapse certification and reinstatement processes. In the past, we've had people who have not been sworn attempt to argue that they were performing police duties or assisting, trying to make argument as to why they should have their certification reinstated. I would just like to add certified and sworn to kind of shore that up. So there is no question as to what the requirement is to be able to maintain your certification. And I think by adding certified and sworn, before it just said certified, I think it'll be clearer for all involved. And that's just for your information. Does anybody have any concerns about that? Representative Greenwood will be carrying this bill. The last one I just want to mention to you, and please look at it and maybe give me your thoughts at a later date, just to review this statute and tell me what you think about it. I'm not looking for a discussion or anything like that.
Okay. Thank you, Director Stevenson. Brings us to our last item agenda, which is scheduling our next meeting, which I believe will be in Salt Lake at Post.
Yes. Usually we try for the first week of December, since that month is usually pretty busy. I think Wednesday was the best day, or was it Monday? Do you remember? Let's try Monday the 2nd. Oh, strike that. I'm on vacation. But we can still have the meeting. Deputy Director Sparks is more than capable. You want to do the first week or the second week of December?
First week's fine, but Jim, I missed our meeting this morning. Did you guys
discuss the Christmas party when you wanted to do that?
We set a date. I will talk to you.
Okay. All right. Is it that first week?
Yeah.
Glad I caught that. My wife killed me.
Probably that 6.
Okay. So do we want to try to do it coincide with that, maybe? I don't know. For those that have to drive up? Of the 6th? Are we doing it on the 6th?
That was our agenda.
That's a Friday.
Is there any way we can do it on the 6th? Is that possible?
Where this body?
For the people that have to drive up from the south. I don't know.
Okay.
How does that sound?
That's the
6th.
6th?
6th.
SF3.
I know. That's why I'm throwing it out there.
We coordinated with our own meeting.
It's fine with me.
Do
that. Are we invited to the party?
Yeah, of course you are. We'd love to have you.
And the six worked for me.
You've got to put on a funny hat and dance for us.
Six?
10.
10 o'clock at post.
All right, any member of the council have anything we need to discuss before I take a motion to adjourn? Anyone? Lamont, you should make the motion to adjourn. 7 minutes longer than I told you it'd be.
I'll make the motion to adjourn.
Good. You have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you all.